And thanks so much for the warmth and encouragement and love which has been shown to me. It's a real privilege to be here. So this session, I'm going to be looking at some issues at the beginning of life and issues at the end of life. And I'm going to try and pack in quite a lot in a short time, so I'm going to go quite fast. There'll be a chance for Q&A and talk in greater detail this afternoon. And my book, Matters of Life and Death, is really, I'm trying to summarize in some way some of the material in that book, which deals in greater detail with. So if you want to go in greater detail, that's probably the most relevant book that you would find. Okay, so as you've already heard, I spent a lot of time working as a baby doctor, and as technology advances, it raises more and more questions. Are we doing the right thing, keeping babies alive with technology? Is there ever a point of time which we should actually switch off the life support machinery and allow a baby to die? And how do we make those decisions? Who should make those decisions? Should it be the parents who make the decisions? Should it be the doctors? Should it be the law courts? So there are many complex issues. This is an MRI scan of a very young baby, a premature baby, and it shows bleeding in the center of the brain. And we can predict increasingly accurately what the long-term consequences would be of this kind of damage, whether it's going to cause cerebral palsy, how it might affect the thinking parts of the brain, and so on. But the question is, when we've got all this information, how do we use it? How do we make, oh, thanks very much, that's great. How do we make decisions about medical decisions about life and death and so on? And the whole question of prenatal screening is also a huge issue. So at the moment, the NHS has decided that every pregnant woman should be offered genetic screening and testing looking for an abnormality of the unborn baby. And quite frequently, abnormalities, genetic differences and changes are identified. And one of the commonest ones is Down syndrome. And every time Down syndrome is diagnosed before birth, parents will be offered the choice of having an abortion. And the statistics show that when parents are offered an abortion in this situation, 9 out of 10 choose to have an abortion. And for every child that's identified with Down syndrome, tragically, there's also a risk that a healthy child will die because of the testing procedure. So the amniocentesis itself carries a risk of causing a miscarriage and therefore the death of what's probably a healthy child. So this is a hugely painful and challenging issue, and it can be calculated that there are many hundreds, if not thousands, of missing children in our society. Children with conditions such as Down syndrome and spina bifida and a whole range of other disorders who ought to be here, but have actually, their lives have been destroyed in the womb. And if you think that's bad and difficult, it's about to get a whole lot worse. And that's because of this thing which is called non-invasive prenatal diagnosis. It turns out that during pregnancy, a small amount of the fetal genetic material, the DNA, is actually circulating in the mother's bloodstream. And so it's now possible to do a simple blood test in the mother and isolate the fetal DNA and then use that to basically work out the genetics of the unborn child. And at the moment, that's being used for conditions such as Down syndrome and other major genetic conditions. But actually, it's been shown that it's possible to use this technique to get a complete readout of the baby's DNA. So fast forward 5 or 10 years, and you or your daughter or your wife is pregnant, and everyone's happy, and she goes along to the clinic, and they say, we'd just like to do a blood test to check the baby's all right. And then you come back in 2 weeks later, and you say, well, you're having a little girl, congratulations, but unfortunately, there's a 60 to 70% chance that she's going to get breast or ovarian cancer before the age of 60, and there's an increased risk of type 2 diabetes, and we're also worried about early onset Alzheimer's disease. Now, do you think it would be responsible for you to bring this child into the world. And so you can just see the sort of dilemmas and issues which just ordinary people who've never thought about anything like this are going to be confronted with just because of, as technology advances. So one of the real challenges is that modern science, and particularly genetics and other technology, is giving us the kind of knowledge which before only God himself could have. You know, how would you know how somebody was going to die in 50 years' time? But God-like knowledge leads to God-like responsibility. And the problem is that how we are going as a human race to cope with that kind of knowledge. I actually think there's a very strong reason to say we don't want to have that kind of testing before birth, that it's actually better not to know. I think the way that God has planned it is that you meet your newborn baby almost like a little stranger. You don't know really anything about this little baby, but you just fall in love with them because they're just so nice and cuddly, and you fall in love with this lovely little baby. And then over the next 18 years, you discover all the revolting and unpleasant genetic characteristics. But by then it's too late because you've already fallen in love with them. Whereas what happens with this prenatal testing is that it turns it around. You learn a whole lot about your baby before you've met them. And actually, I think that changes and distorts the relationship. We're supposed to meet our children first and then discover about them. So there is a case to say we don't want that kind of antenatal testing. There is some antenatal testing which is actually helpful for the baby. And in that situation, yes, that kind of testing, if there is some treatment that's available, would be beneficial. But if it's genetic testing just to know what the genetics is, then I actually think the right thing to do, personally, would be to say, we don't want that testing. This is a graph, just the red line shows the number of babies who would have been born with Down syndrome, and the green line shows the actual number. So the difference between the red and the green are all the missing children with Down syndrome. And as the technology has improved, some people are saying, don't screen us out, as though... It's very interesting, you know, this whole prenatal testing has never been subjected to proper democratic discussion and debate. Parliament has never sat around and said, we think Down syndrome is such a terrible condition that we should devote all this technology to try and eradicate it. It's just something that has slowly emerged, basically because we can do it, and the doctors and technologists have introduced this practice without sort of proper discussion. And there are people, particularly disabled people, who feel that this whole approach is a form of discrimination. It's allowing the normal majority, the quotes healthy normal majority, to discriminate against people who are different, people in wheelchairs, people who get in the way, people who are not the same as us. If we look at the painful issue of abortion, at least we have reasonably reliable statistics. In most countries, actually, abortion statistics are really very unreliable and are not present. But in the UK, every year, the government publishes detailed statistics. And although they're not 100% reliable, they are pretty reliable. And these are the most recent data. So the total number of abortions is just under 200,000. Compare that with about 700,000 live births. So you can calculate that about one in four pregnancies, between one in four and one in five pregnancies will end in an abortion. The majority are carried out in unmarried women, but not all. And 98% are funded by the NHS, although actually 70% of those take place in private clinics. So the commonest way in which abortions are carried out are actually in private clinics, where the BPAS or Mary Stopes are organizations that run these private clinics. And you don't need to go through a GP, you don't need to see a doctor. All you need to do is ring a helpline, and then you can have an appointment sometimes the same day or the following day. And the idea, and the NHS will pay for it. So the idea is to try and remove barriers to abortion to make it plain. And yet, that means that many, many people are having abortions without proper counseling or thought about what the implications might be. People often talk about the so-called hard cases of abortion. That's things like fetal abnormality, which we've already talked about, or somebody who's pregnant through rape, or where the mother's life is at risk. It's important to realize that actually they are very rare relative to the common kind of abortions. The vast majority of abortions happen because of so-called social reasons. The numbers that are done because of risk of disability is less than 2%. The numbers that are done because of risk to the mother's life is less than 1 in 1,000. It's about 1 in 2,000. So those situations are actually very rare, and they're not really relevant to far and away the most common kinds of abortion. If you look across the world, again, abortion is just one of those extraordinarily worldwide things. 56 million abortions every year across the world. And tragically and paradoxically, the highest rate of abortions are actually in developing countries compared with rich countries, even though in most developing countries, abortion is completely illegal or very severely restrained. So the vast majority of abortions are carried out illegally. And I think this is important because it tells us that the primary issue is not about the law. In some countries have a very liberal regime, as in the UK. Some countries have a very restrictive regime, but actually, the total number of abortions is very similar. So the primary issue is not about the law. And I like the slogan, which has come from an American group, that says, "Our goal is not to make abortion illegal, it is to make it unthinkable." In other words, the primary issue is not about the law. The primary issue is about attitudes. It's about how we value life. And another example that is given is the issue of slavery. If you were to go back 200 years or a bit more, what you would find is that slavery was both legal, at least in some countries, but it was also thinkable. In fact, lots of Christian people supported it. It was just seen as normal and natural. Whereas now, attitudes have changed. So now slavery has become unthinkable. Yes, I know it still goes on, but people say, but to take another human being and subject them to your will and imprison them, that's wrong. So it shows that social attitudes can change, and by God's grace, the same could happen with abortion. It could be that by God's grace, in 50 or 100 years' time, people say, why would you kill your baby? I mean, it's just unthinkable that you should consider that as a possibility. So that's our goal. Our goal is to change attitudes. Another tragic thing is that across the world, female selective abortion is very, very common, although, again, it's illegal. And people have calculated there are hundreds of millions of missing girls who've been selectively aborted because people wanted boys. And I think of some of these most tragic words in the whole of the Bible. In Jeremiah, a voice is heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping. Rachel is weeping for her children. She refuses to be comforted for her children because they're no more. And one of the things I've become to realize is there's a kind of spiritual obscenity about abortion. It's not just a social issue. It's not just an ethical issue. But, you know, in the biblical narrative, God is a God of compassion. Time and again in the Old Testament, it talks about the nature of God, that he is a God of compassion. Did you know that the word rahamim, which is used for the compassion of God, is taken from the womb? It's the same word, or derived from the word for womb. So God is a motherly father, and the womb is a place of compassion. And then God himself invades the womb in the person of Jesus, in those little pictures, you know, that tiny little, the mother of my Lord. So the womb becomes even a kind of sacred place because it's a place that God himself has invaded. It's a place of safety. It's a place of compassion. It's a place of security. And then the evil one says, ah, no, I am going to change the womb into the killing fields. And I'm going to make it a place of destruction. And what's more, I'm going to do it not through terrorists and murderers. I'm going to do it through doctors. I'm going to do it through healthcare professionals. And I'm going to use them as the executioners. Ha ha, just look at that. There's something spiritually very obscene about it. So whenever we talk about these issues, it's not just an ethical issue. Actually, it's a spiritual battle. And those of us who work in this field, we know that this is a spiritual battle. And we need your prayers because the evil one regards this as his territory. This is my place. You can have your worship services. You can do what you like. But when it comes to abortion, this is my place. This is the place where I'm in control. So this is a spiritual battle. But things are happening, and I'll come to that. I just want to say something else. The original arguments about abortion were based on compassion. So it was in the time of the backstreet abortions in the 1960s was when abortion was first legalized. And so abortion should be only available in extreme circumstances, and the argument was compassion. Then what happened historically was that the whole rise of feminism changed the arguments. And now it changes. Now it's not about compassion. Now it's about liberation. It's my right to choose. It's my body. And so the arguments then were very much about liberation. Now it's changing again. There's still, you get some of that feminist argument that it's my body and so on. But often what I hear is an argument based on responsibility. Actually, if you're going to bring a child into the world who's unwanted, you're not going to be able to give the very best kind of education. You're not going to be able to, you know, this is the wrong time to have a child. Then it's responsible to have an abortion. In fact, you're being irresponsible to bring a baby into the world in these circumstances. So there's that tragic and painful issue. And again, I know that there are people here who have been affected by it, and I'm not saying this in any sense to try and make you feel uncomfortable or judged, but just to share the reality of what's going on. So the age-old ethical challenges are about the taking of human life, the destruction of life. And that includes abortion. It also includes infanticide, killing newborn babies. And it also includes euthanasia and suicide. But there are new challenges, which are not about the taking of life. And I'm sorry, this is a bit slick, but they're about the making, the shaping, and the faking of life. So they are reproductive technology, making life. There's the shaping or the manipulation of life using drugs or using electrodes in the brain or merging between humans and machines. And there's the faking of human life, which is really about AI and robotics. So these are new challenges, and they are very complicated and constantly changing, and I don't have any simple answers. But reproductive technology. When I was a medical student, I went to a lecture. This is back in the 70s. I went to a lecture on human reproduction. And what I learned was that a man and a woman had sexual intercourse. And 9 months later, a baby came out. So I wrote it all down very carefully in my notebook. Although I'd just worked that out before from the toilet walls at my school. But if you were to go to the same lecture today, it's very different. What you would learn is that you need to have a source of eggs. You need to have a source of sperm. You need to have a womb or a uterus. And then you need to have somebody to care for the baby. So you've got four variables, and there's no reason why any of these variables should be related. There's lots of permutations and combinations. You can have egg donation or embryo donation. You can have surrogate pregnancy and so on. And that's meant that the whole thing has become very, very complicated and very confusing. And we live in a confusing and confused world. And so just as an example of the confusion, there have been cases where a mother, a woman was dying of cancer, a younger woman, and she asked for her eggs to be removed and for embryos to be created and then to be donated to her mother. So her mother, that happened, and her mother became pregnant with the eggs from her daughter. So at the same time, she is both the grandmother and the mother of the babies. And, you know, that's just an example of the kind of complications and confusions of things that can happen. And this is a sort of amazing and tragic case from July 2016. So the person on the left is a genetic female who decided to transition to a male and who therefore took male hormones. And he stroke she had a female partner they then decided to have a baby, and because the genetic male still had a womb, was impregnated with a baby and so became pregnant. And he describes himself, he strokes she, as a pregnant father. And again, it just sort of illustrates the complications and confusions that technology is. And so one of the things that's happening in our culture is this, that consumerism says, I want to have a baby. I don't want to have a baby. I want to have this kind of baby. And moral relativism says, well, why not? How can we say this is wrong? How can we argue that you shouldn't be allowed to have your wishes? And then technology says, we can make it happen. We can fulfill your dreams, but it's going to cost you. And the cost is not just economic, of course. Often the cost is personal and emotional and human. The technology now allows us to modify human embryos and to actually take an embryo at a very early stage and change particular segments of the DNA. And so on the positive side, this might mean that it actually be possible to cure terrible genetic conditions like sickle cell disease, thalassemia, Huntington's disease, and so on. But on the negative side, it opens up the prospect of so-called designer babies, that you could actually create and design an embryo to suit, to improve the intelligence or to change its characteristics to make the baby that you want. And people say, well, look, if you can spend thousands of pounds on education, thousands of pounds giving your baby the very best chance in life, why can't you spend thousands of pounds giving your baby the very best DNA? Give your baby the best genes. I mean, what's wrong with that? And so, again, you can just see the complexities and confusion. So these new emerging technologies have enormous therapeutic potential. They can do a huge amount of good, but they always have this inherent tendency for manipulating and, to use a long word, instrumentalizing vulnerable human lives. That means you're treating a human being as an instrument, as something you can manipulate. And of course, as we think about what it means to be human, if you think about that first talk, that clashes against this idea that to be human is to be a flawed masterpiece, a being of unique and special value. So C.S. Lewis, writing at the end of the Second World War, said, man's power over nature turns out to be power exerted by some men over other men. It's a very profound, wise statement. What sounds is like it's just science, it's just power over nature, actually, it's power right some people over other people. And it's the strong abusing the weak, the vulnerable, and those who have no voice. So how do we respond to some of these issues? And I haven't time to talk in detail, but I just want to talk about one particular initiative, which I think is a wonderful Christian response. You know, whenever we say that something is wrong, we must immediately go on to say, and here is a better way. It's not good enough to just say it's wrong, it's bad, it's evil, it's no good, we're opposed to that, Christians don't like that, Christians hate that. That's not good enough. And I'm afraid I so often hear that voice in the media and in the public debate, which just says things are wrong. Yes, we've got to be able to say things are wrong, but we must immediately go on and say, and here is a better way. So what is the better way when it comes to the issue of abortion? Well, I think I'm very encouraged by the growth of the Christian pregnancy centers, sometimes called crisis pregnancy centers, which is a movement which has started in the States, moved here, is spreading across the world. And my wife has run a crisis pregnancy center in London for many years, Choices Islington. And I'm a trustee there, and we work closely together. Her usual line is, she says, oh yes, my husband, he goes around and talks about ethics. I actually do it, which is fair enough. I try and do it as well sometimes. And they talk about this wonderful verse in John that in Jesus what we see is grace and truth. If you just have truth by itself without grace, truth can be quite destructive, quite damaging. You know, you come across people who use truth without grace, and truth without grace can be very damaging and destructive. Grace without truth is very soft, very compassionate, but actually it has no power. Worse, grace without truth is actually a lie. But if you have grace and truth mingled together, inextricably intertwined, then you have something very powerful, which is the character of Jesus himself. And so that's how these groups try and do. They try and reach out to people with an unplanned pregnancy or being troubled by abortion with grace and truth. And so this is the Choices website. And the majority of people can now come to Choices actually just by Googling. If you type in abortion help, then the Choices website will come up pretty well on the first page in London. And they offer free counseling. They don't splash the fact that they're Christian and or pro-life or anything like that, but they're quite clear about the fact, if asked, that they're a faith-based organization. They're completely independent from the medical NHS. They're independent from the abortion clinics. They're there just to provide a safe space. They've got a shop front on the Caledonian Road where people can come. They provide post-abortion support. They have a whole abortion recovery program. They provide work in prisons called Choice for Change in women's prisons, supporting women, some of whom are pregnant when they get into the prison and have a decision about whether to have an abortion, some of whom have lost children in different kind of ways. They provide Christian relationships and sexual health education in schools as a kind of preventative thing, helping particularly girls. There's terrific pressure under young girls to basically have sex with boys, because if you don't have sex with boys, you're frigid. You're not a proper girl at all. And just giving girls the right to say no, and that you're worth more than that, and your body is something precious. A huge amount of work just to help girls not give way to this sexual promiscuity. They provide a befriending service for women who decide to continue the pregnancy. So often single, unsupported women, sometimes subject to violence, and they provide a service. Many of them are very poor and don't have resources, so they provide a free baby boutique with clothing and equipment, which is donated equipment for women who are continuing the pregnancy. They provide a community mums group. So this is practical Christian compassion, and it's making a difference. A whole series of women have chose to continue the pregnancy who are considering having an abortion, and it's demonstrating Christian compassion and grace and truth. And I would love it if there were more centers like this around the country. There are something like 50 or 60, but there are many, many places. I forgot to look up whether there's one in Derby. But is there one, do you know? There is one, yeah. But I mean, maybe I could encourage and challenge you. If abortion and these kind of issues are on your heart, if you feel touched and moved by this and you'd like to do something positive to respond, well, this is a way of showing Christian compassion. This is a way of showing a Christian response, of putting our money where our mouth is. If we say life is precious, then we need to demonstrate it. And perhaps, maybe you could even think about starting a group here in the church and think about what the implications would be of actually demonstrating practically, of making a difference. A very close friend of ours at All Souls Church, Alan and Verity, it was their first baby, they were pregnant, we knew them well, we were celebrating and so on. And then the news turned to tragedy because it turned out that the baby had Edwards syndrome, which is like Down syndrome, only much worse, and is sort of pretty much universally lethal. And Alan and Verity had a huge pressure to have an abortion. What possible reason could there be to continue the pregnancy when you know the baby's going to die? Why put yourself through it? Why put the baby through it? It's just ridiculous. But after a lot of heart searching, Alan and Verity said, look, this is the baby that God has given us. How can we kill that baby? And so little baby Christopher was born. To everyone's surprise, he didn't die straight away. In fact, he survived for months. And they used to bring him along to All Souls Church, where he became like a mini celebrity. He He was only 5 pounds, 2.5 kilos, but everybody wanted to have a cuddle. So he used to get passed from arm to arm. And everybody knew about baby Christopher. And after 7 months, he got weaker and weaker and eventually died in that home with his parents. And they had a memorial service, a Thanksgiving service, and 400 people turned up to pay tribute to baby Christopher. And he was still the same size when he died. He was still 5 pounds. And one of their friends said, you know, Christopher couldn't grow, but he helped other people to grow. And it suddenly struck me. I was writing my book, Matters of Life and Death, at the time, and I thought, you know, this is Christian theology in action. This is what it looks like. If you say life is precious, then these little lives is actually, because Christopher too was a flawed masterpiece. And it was a privilege to know him. He touched many lives. So Christian love is a way of saying to another, it's good that you exist. It's good that you're in the world. You know, the trouble with abortion and with euthanasia is it says it's bad that you exist. It'd be much better for the world if you didn't exist. Now, it seems to me Christian love never says that. It always says it's good that you exist. It's good that you're in the world. And what we've got to do is find ways of saying that and meaning it and showing it. It's good that you exist. It's good that you're in the world. So just very briefly, I just want to talk about issues at the end of life, but I don't want to go into the fish and chips. I've got strict instructions. I mustn't invade the fish and chips. So 6 minutes on death and dying. So as you know, there's this big epidemic of people, if you're saying they want to die, headlines of people going to the Dignitas Clinic in Switzerland, and there's a huge pressure to make both euthanasia and assisted suicide legal. Holland is the place which is where euthanasia has advanced to the greatest extent, advanced in quotes. It's now euthanasia for cancer is completely routine in Holland. Somewhere between 4%, 5%, up to 10% of people die through a version of euthanasia, of all deaths in Holland. Now the issue in Holland is about euthanasia for psychiatric conditions, euthanasia for children, euthanasia for Alzheimer's disease, and euthanasia for people who are just, quote, tired of life, who feel they've had their life, they want to die. And doctors are under enormous pressure. I was just speaking recently at a doctors' group in Holland, and I was hearing about the amount of pressure on doctors, that it's your job. I'm suffering, and your job as a doctor is to stop suffering, and the way you stop my suffering is by killing me. And that is the sort of attitudes in the population as a whole is remarkable. So I'm afraid there's an epidemic of this spreading across the world. California is one of the latest states in the USA to legalize it. As we all know, what happens in California this year is going to spread around the world next year. And Canada is now legalized assisted suicide, and it's rapidly spreading and growing there. So one of the issues is about Alzheimer's disease. Many people are worrying about Alzheimer's disease, and worries about, these are projections for the UK, 800,000 in 2012, going to 1.7 million in 2051. And people are saying, well, how are we going to cope with this in our society? And maybe the solution is to kill people. If you distill down the arguments, they basically come down to either compassion, I'm such a caring person that I have to help you kill yourself, or autonomy, every person has the right to choose the time and the manner of their death. And I like this quote from American journalist, there's always an easy solution to every human problem, neat, plausible, and wrong. And that's what euthanasia is. It seems so neat, it seems so plausible, but it's wrong. And I haven't really time to go into unpack it in greater detail. Again, those two books, Right to Die, looks at the arguments in much more detail about those arguments from compassion and autonomy, and also at the positive aspects of caring for dying people. And the new book, Dying Well, looks at positive alternatives. I just want to fast forward, if I may, and talk about palliative care, because, again, whenever we say that something is wrong, we have to say that here is a better way. And palliative care was invented by Christian people. In fact, it was invented particularly by this lady, Cicely Saunders, who was a wonderful Christian doctor. Used to go to All Souls initially. And she was caring for dying people actually as a nurse. She went back and trained as a doctor. And she realized that it was possible to care for dying people in a way that showed Christian compassion. And one of her slogans was, "You matter because you are you, and you matter to the end of your life. Not only will we help you to die well, we'll help you to live before you die. You don't have to kill the patient in order to kill the pain." She realized that many people at the end of their life had not just physical pain, because actually physical pain is quite easy to control. But you often hear about people who are dying in terrible agony. You sometimes hear these terrible stories about people calling out in pain and so on. Well, I can guarantee to you that if that is happening and the people are receiving decent medical care, then it's not physical pain. But there are other kinds of pain that don't respond to painkillers. And that's psychological pain or relational pain or spiritual pain. And so proper palliative care is about seeing the whole person and dealing with every aspect, the things that are there. And I love this quote: "Suffering is not a question which demands an answer. It's not a problem which demands a solution. It's a mystery which demands a presence." You know, so often we're keen to come up with answers. We're keen to come up with solutions, but actually sometimes there aren't. But we can always be the presence. In the mystery of suffering, we're called to be the presence of Christ. And I have to say, as a Christian doctor, that to me is one of the greatest privileges possible. Not to be able to be come up with solutions and solve problems and save lives, but just to be there with people who are suffering. There's no higher privilege. But that's something that all of us can play a role of. But it's all not all negative, because dying well, and that's where I wrote this last book, is actually a fantastic opportunity. There are all kinds of positive things that can come out of dying. A time for focusing on things which really matter, a time for saying sorry, for receiving a fresh grace, for fulfilling dreams, for relinquishing tasks, for learning new lessons, for passing on to loved ones, for encouraging those. So, and I'll close here, God's plan for this age is not to abolish human suffering, but to redeem it. It's to bring blessing and healing out of the most terrible, evil, and awful things. And I've come to the conclusion there's nothing that can happen, however terrible, however apparently just capricious and meaningless and destructive, there's nothing which in some sense God cannot turn it round into blessing and healing. I say that by faith, I can't prove it, but I've seen it happen so many times. And therefore, by trust in a powerful God, we can trust him to redeem the pain. And I'll close with this. You know, in secular thinking, life starts from nowhere. It develops, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and everything's getting better, and you learn more, and your body's getting stronger, and you're learning things, and then you hit 25. And from 25 onwards, you are down the long, slow hope and sliding down. Bit by bit, things are getting worse and your body's cracking up and your cells are dying and your hair's going gray and your skin's going flabby and on it goes. And eventually, so much damage and wreckage and then you die. And that's it. That's life. But in Christian thinking, life starts from nowhere, and then it grows, and it grows, and it grows, and it grows. The path of the righteous is like the first gleam of dawn, shining ever brighter until the full light of day. And I came across this picture on the internet of two climbers who climbed up in Alaska, and they were looking, clinging onto the peak in the dark. They'd climbed through the night, and as they clung onto this peak, they watched for the dawn, and there was the first gleam of dawn. And you know what it's like? You've been through, you're traveling through the night and it's pitch black and the night goes on and on and on and on, and then out there you see it. You see that first blush of dawn and you know that the day is coming. Inexorably, moment by moment, the day is coming. And that's the image. That's how we've got to live. Yes, we're walking through the darkness. Yes, it's a very dark time sometimes. But out there on the dawn, if you've only got eyes to see it, on the horizon is the dawn, the first gleam of dawn. So we live with our eyes fixed on what is coming, the full light of day. Let me just close in prayer. Heavenly Father, I just pray that you would write these truths deep into our hearts. We thank you for your grace. We thank you for the wonder of life. We pray against the evil one as he tries to destroy and distort and twist. And we pray that you would give us ears to hear what you are saying to us. And if you want us to be involved in some of these areas, if you want us to show practical Christian compassion, then speak to us clearly. And we pray it in the name of the Lord Jesus. Amen.